Welcome to the Journal of Biophilic Design podcast. Well, many thanks for joining us on the Journal of Biophilic Design podcast today. I suspect that many, if not all of our listeners, will be aware that there is a British Institute of Interior Design, known in the industry affectionately as BID. If you're a designer, it's definitely worth joining, not least because of the brilliant awards they run, although it is open to every interior designer as well. If you're keen to enter, the deadline this year is on the 10th of April, 2024. And in fact, we've got two winners joining us here today, along with one of the judges. We're going to be talking about their designs, their inspiration, and also about sustainability, but also why, as designers, we should bother about entering awards. You know, what difference does it actually make to our practice? So without further ado, I'm thrilled to be joined by representatives of two great design houses, James Gavigan of the House of Kin and Susie Pfeiffer of Pfeiffer Design, both of whom are previous winners. And also joining us in the booth today is one of the judges, Asif Din, who's Director of Regenerative Design at Perkins & Will. So many thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Hello.
Hi.
Lovely. Great, thank you. Maybe we can start with a quick introduction from yourselves. Maybe James, you can start first, please. Tell us a bit about yourself and about your practice, please.
Hi to everybody listening. It's nice to be the other side of the microphone listening, talking instead of listening this time around. We're a House of Kin. We're, I suppose, a little bit different than the norm, in that our main clientele are children normally, or families, in relation to the focus of our design practice. We're pretty much multidisciplinary. We're not solely for interiors. We do exteriors, we do installations, we do museums, private members clubs, whatever it is that kind of where the children end up, we look at it from a different lens, essentially. So it's a really cool place to get very creative in, and we get to break all the normal rules that everybody else has to stick to when it comes to, you know, making things for grown-ups. It's a fun area to work in.
That's lovely, thanks. And I can see actually how that's that plays out in the piece we're going to talk about in a bit. So, and Susie, can you introduce yourself, please, in your practice?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, my name's Susie Pfeiffer. I qualified as an interior architect in 1989, when no one knew what interior design was. I started my company Pfeiffer Design in about 2007, and we are a team of eight now, and based here in rural Sussex. We specialise in high-end residential projects solely. We do some commercial, but mostly it's high-end residential. And I suppose our company ethos is to really infuse our homes for our clients with elements of their personality and their life story, so they don't become bland designed spaces, but really evolve to showcase their lives. That's really what we try and do. So we don't really have a house style, so to speak. We kind of listen to what they want.
That's lovely. I like that. Showcase their house, their style. That's nice angle.
Thank you.
Asif, if you could introduce yourself, please, and what you do there.
Right. My name's Asif. I've already been introduced, but at Perkins & Will, I'm sort of the conscience. I effectively look over all of the designs in the office. And so there's around about 140 designers. This goes from a range of scales, from planning countries, essentially, large-scale master planning, all the way to corporate interiors. So in a similar sort of way, you know, sort of like, we don't have a house style either. It's more about listening and making sure that we're actually delivering something that's important to the client.
Oh, so it's brilliant. That's nice to hear. It's refreshing as well to hear that you're listening to the people who you're designing for rather than dictating, yes, we're going to have it painted all pink. So maybe we could start the conversation, but about why, as designers, Susie and James, and I can ask you guys first, why should we bother? Why do you bother entering awards? You know, what difference does it make to your practice? I mean, Susie, maybe you could start with that one, please.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's been incredibly beneficial for us, aside from giving us a great platform to showcase our projects, of course. Winning or even being shortlisted for an award creates amazing opportunities to connect us with our industry. We're here in rural Sussex, you know, doing it on our own, and just think, is anyone out there? And actually, it was amazing for us and the team when we won, especially for sustainability, because we beaver away here and don't know anyone else is watching. And it kind of puts you on a platform to be a company that others will look to, especially suppliers. It gives me opportunity like this to talk for the British Institute, and obviously attracting new clients. That's always one of the best things as well, because it kind of gives you kudos. But also I think it kind of elevates the whole design community and elevates design standards, especially when you're talking about sustainability and fostering creativity, so that design doesn't become bland. You know, that's really what I feel for our company.
Yeah, that's a lot great. Yeah, so design doesn't become bland. That's yes, true. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, and James, for you?
Yeah, I think I'd probably just build on what Susie said, to be honest. I mean, exposure is obviously a massive part of winning any award in any industry. And I suppose for what we do in House of Kin, because we do things very differently, again, then industry recognition is an interesting angle, because we are really challenging things a lot of the time, and being able to then have that conversation with other people in the industry, and even kind of cross-pollination, I find has started as a result of winning the award of bid, where we're, you know, traditionally we're working towards commercial clients directly, but now we're having discussions with massive architecture firms where we're the specialists in what we do. And I suppose you don't necessarily get to have those introductions otherwise, which is a very cool kind of new end of things for us. And I suppose also we do things from a very different angle by way of the process that we approach. So we call ourselves creators of playful worlds, which essentially means that we create a story at the beginning of everyone's journey, because we work through a brand book. And then that informs then for all of our commercial clients very much how we kind of work through their process. So kind of talking about that with other people industry-wise is also interesting, because I suppose because of our mixed backgrounds, myself and Anna, we don't come from a traditional architecture background, which I think gives us a very different eye on design as well. And also kind of lets us probably break the rules from materials and sustainability point of view as well. But yeah, I'd say then just industry recognition. It's nice to kind of stand up there and people to go, oh yeah, okay, you guys are doing it, and it's worth talking about. So yeah, probably exactly what Susie said, but just a long-winded way of saying it.
It's great, because also, I mean, if your name gets sort of like showcased in lights, or, you know, you go to the award ceremony and all this kind of thing, there's also that networking opportunity, isn't there, where this collaboration, the magic happens, and like might open your, you know, your eyes to a different thing. I mean, Asif, for you, obviously as a judge, you get the sort of I would say, like, it was a hard job, but probably a really lovely job as well, because you must get to see some amazing designs. But I mean, how on earth do you go about judging like a level of sustainability, for instance? I mean, you know, what sort of criteria do you use?
It's kind of easy, because in matter of fact, you can look at a project and very, very quickly ascertain that whether they've actually considered the environment, the users, a range of different aspects within the project, or whether it was just an afterthought and it's something that they placed in afterwards. Both in Susie's and James's projects, those were just, you know, they pretty much stood out almost immediately, because you know that effectively from the off, they were considering these things and it was a natural fruition. It wasn't something that was an add-on at the end with, you know, sort of like we'll put in some kit, or we'll put in, you know, sort of like a cork wall or something else. It was done from the very start, and it's very, very plain to see in both of those projects.
Yeah, so you can really see it makes a difference when like a designer or an architect or whatever it is, whichever practice, is actually like woven right into the grassroots, in, you know, into the scene.
Absolutely.
Project. Yeah. Do you think we can compromise on the look and feel of something, you know, just to meet sustainability or net zero targets? You know, do you think, you know, we can do that?
It should be invisible, because in matter of fact, I think, you know, sort of like material substitution is one thing, but if you are designing for the client, the materiality will come out and will be appropriate for its use.
Yeah.
I think James's project demonstrates that very, very clearly. It's obviously designed for children, the materiality is chosen specifically for children. And whether they're sustainable materials or not, you know, sort of like it functions incredibly well. Mm-hmm. If it didn't function well and it was made of, you know, sort of like grass or straw or something else, then in matter of fact, it wouldn't be a successful project. The whole thing with James's project is effectively those materials were chosen, but they were appropriate for that design.
And James, let's talk to you about that then. So do you feel, you know, I mean, obviously sustainability matters to you. Do you feel you can kind of compromise? Do you feel like, or do you feel like it's like it adds to the quality or something? I mean, what's your take?
Thanks a lot, Asif. I mean, that's a great ego boost for the day. I'll take that all week. I think Asif picks up on something that's a really good point, and that is that especially with our end user, you know, durability is a massive thing, and durability without a look or without, you know, good reason. We've all seen the bad versions of what a classroom looks like or what a healthcare environment looks like or whatever else, you know, in that sphere. And it's always been a challenge to us, I suppose, through our experience in, I suppose, road testing these materials. We were in-house in a company called Maggie and Rose, myself and Anna, who my business partner, for many years. So we had a great opportunity to, I suppose, make the mistakes with new materials. Whether that be, you know, plastic bottles have been chopped up and squeezed into a sheet in the very first instances and find out that they just bend and they don't work and they take paint badly, or, you know, whatever it was, we started, like, you know, pushing the boundaries in those things. But I suppose it's finding the sweet spot, and it's also making sure that, you know, you're not trying to do everything. I think people are really getting lost today in all ends of sustainability in their own lives and in massive design. And I think it's important picking out those parts that are really, really important and that will also give, I suppose, for us, brand value to our hospitality and commercial clients. You know, I suppose a nice thing that we talk about with a lot of our clients is being quietly sustainable. And I think for an early part, a lot of the materials that were coming out, they were very obviously formerly something else. So it was obviously a plastic bottle before. It was obviously some wood that had been chopped up and made into something before. And a lot of the materials that are coming out now are just doing what the old products did. And I think being able to make those decisions feels better. And then everybody kind of, there's no greenwashing as an issue for anybody, and everybody in the process feels better about it, you know. But yeah, it has to fit its purpose, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? As technology and you know, these kind of manufacturing get more sophisticated, the more the demand as well, isn't it? The more industry demands and clients demand, we want sustainability, we want nice design. Why should we compromise, really? Susie, for you, you know, what do you think we could compromise, or do you feel like it's just
I think the sustainability compromising aesthetics is it's actually a misconception, and one that we actively try and dispel in our projects and to our clients. I mean, I echo what James said, so I won't talk about materiality again, but I think for us, because we're working very closely with the end user, that sustainable design, if we enhance it right from the beginning with our concepts and talk to our clients about it, it can enhance the look and feel of a space and contribute to their deeper, more meaningful aesthetic that resonates with the principles of balance with nature. Therefore, our clients know the reasons that we've chosen those materials, those fabrics, those technological advancements that go into the design choices and impacts on their environments, and this elevates the design in their minds and making their space feel more purposeful to them as well. So that's really where we come from that emotional level, as well obviously as the materiality, but just kind of trying to install that into our clients.
Yeah, that's really nice. It's an education piece as well, isn't it? It's like
exactly, because sometimes people don't think with residential interior design that you can bring that sustainability into the materials. But we try to show them that you can, yeah, on a macro level and on a smaller level as well. I'll talk about that a bit later when we talk about our project.
That's great. Lovely. I mean, obviously you won the Anna Whitehead Prize for Sustainability. Asif, can I ask you what is that prize, please? You know, there's this Anna Whitehead Prize.
It's for the project that shows the most amount that talks about sustainability, that actually demonstrates it to the public. Anna Whitehead was a fantastic person who actually advocated this before it was really fashionable.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's all like over the last 5 years, effectively, it's become more and more fashionable to talk about it. But Anna did this quite early on, working with UKGBC, working with BIID, to actually advocate these aspects, and they should be inherent as part of the design, rather than just, you know, sort of like something, as I said before, that's an add-on, or worse still, greenwashing, and effectively giving lip service to it, but not actually conducting it through the project.
Absolutely. I mean, Susie, can I go back to you now and actually talk about the project itself?
We were lucky enough to be the client, and so we wrote our own brief, because the studio that we won the prize for is for our design practice.
Is that where you are now, by the way? Is that where you are now?
Yeah, it's where we are now. So we were the client, and we built the brief, and we built this premises over the COVID period. And it was built to house the design practice that was growing. Before, we were in a tiny little office, no room. And so I had these big ideas, and very luckily got planning permission, but in a very rural setting with agricultural buildings. So the challenge, if you like, was for the exterior to be quiet and agricultural and not too showy, but for the inside to foster creativity and inspire our staff, and do so in an environmentally friendly manner. So to seamlessly blend the rural environment with our contemporary principles and promote well-being. The exterior is clad in larch, and we've chosen a method of sushugiban, I think that's the way you say it, where you burn the larch to preserve it. So it has a black exterior, although it's not as black as it was in 2020. It's kind of softened with the landscape. And then the inside, it is a steel structure. And so all the steel is exposed. And mixed with this kind of fairly industrial interior, we've mixed in residential finishes. So it's a building that kind of juxtaposes the two elements, or three elements even. And the sustainability aspects were considered right from the beginning, which I have always advocated to my clients, but needed to demonstrate to take away the mysticism of the air source heat pump, of the sedum roof, etc. So that's really why I think we won the sustainability aspect of the bid award that year. Yeah. Did I say enough there?
Yeah, I'm gonna put images on the journalofbiophilicdesign.com podcast page, so people who are listening can go on and have a look. And I'll also put links to your entries on the bid website as well, so people can click through the links in the spiel that goes with
it. I suppose I would like to add that the well-being of the staff was at the forefront of the design choices we've made for the interior, not necessarily for the sustainability aspects, although that contributes to the comfort in internally, but to give them a lovely place to work that was inspiring. We have yoga classes here, and we hold events, and so it's like to try and build, and we're all women, try and build a real team of strong, united women.
That's really nice. And because you created it during lockdown, so I suppose all these things were like, you know, where are the pain points? What can we do if we had an ideal world, sort of thing, you know? I mean, I've read as well that you do rainwater harvesting, you've got insulation, you also used local suppliers.
Yeah. That's right. Yes, we always use local suppliers wherever we can. And all the tradespeople at the time were local. My husband and my son helped build it, because they didn't go off and do their own jobs. Yeah, so this was kind of like the macro view that I was talking about earlier, that the air source heat pump, the insulation, obviously all the lighting, the sedum roof, that those were all the kind of macro elements. But then when we started to inhabit the space, the sustainability aspects of the fabric choices that we made, you know, the fact that leathers can be made of cactus these days. And recycling, upcycling furniture, and we try and install into our clients that they don't have to chuck everything out, that we can, you know, give us the chair that your grandmother gave you, reupholster it, and it will make you feel like you're part of the history of your home. So that's kind of like a very small way. And I think if we all did something in that very small way and not just keep starting again, keep chucking everything out, then I think that will tell the story of people's lives as well as being beneficial to the environment.
That's really nice. I like that, enriching the, you know, enriching the sustainability aspect.
Yeah. The feelings for us is so important for people's homes, and just having those elements that tell those stories of the people that inhabit it are important.
I think it's important as well in the workplace and healthcare, to be honest. I think we should be creating spaces that we feel more than function, you know, more than just tick boxes. I mean, Asif, could you tell me a little bit about, you know, the standout things for you for this project, you know, which made it win?
It would have been quite easy for Susie and her team to effectively create something which was an empty box, effectively as a conversion. But during, you know, sort of like they did a good analysis of what they needed. So, you know, looking at sort of like meeting room spaces, smaller spaces that they can actually draw clients into and actually have a meaningful conversation in privacy, acoustics, well-being in terms of the air quality around them. The items that they used around them, you know, sort of like air source heat pump, range of other things, were not thought about afterwards. They were thought about as part of that system. And I think that was the main standout thing for the project. Effectively, all of the pieces were jigsaw pieces that fitted well together. It wasn't a case of just sort of like, you know, this will fit, bang, 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 to make sure that, or anything that was in some ways superfluous to that system. What Susie's done incredibly well is effectively she's made that showcase for people coming in for her business, but not done it in a sort of like, and here's a air source heat pump, here is rainwater harvesting, when it doesn't actually talk about the building and how the building actually functions. Mm. What all of her clients probably see when they go in is that see how this can work for them and how it can be part of a design that's inherent within that design. It's not something that is, again, going back to the greenwashing aspect, or just saying, I am trying to be green by having this feature. Mm. Everything works together, and that's just shown incredibly well in the project.
That's fantastic. So listeners, it's called Chapel Barn, and have a look on the link that goes with the podcast here. I'm going to go to you now, James, because yours is a completely different project. It's like it's a school project. Yeah. It's bonkers. It's like, you know, it's called so it's House of Kins project, which was the Greater London winner in 2023, and it's a unique nursery, really, isn't it? And I just love it's inside an original church building. The colours and the colour palette, the soft muted colours, it just like. It's sort of seamless. It goes through. I looked at it and thought, God, I want to go in there. You know, and I know you were saying about your design places for adults. Just pick that up and just stick it over here. That would be great. But could you tell us a little bit about more in a professional way? What the was, please? You know, and how sustainability was important to you, maybe, and also the client.
Yeah, I suppose. I like the idea that we design for everybody, to be honest. I think when you design for children, actually, you design a better space for everybody, because things that people put into whole documentation of 100 pages that they call accessibility, we just think about normally. It's not an addition to do that in that moment. So, you know, when it comes to Susie's end of it, into the things when she said that her, you know, her client was herself. I'm kind of envious of that moment and that project where I was like, I convinced myself that the heat pump would be fine. I'm like, yeah, that's a great thing. But I have to say, on this project, we were very lucky to have a brilliant client who had quite a clear idea in her head of what she would like the feeling to be, but not necessarily how it was going to exist. And I suppose that's where our crazy minds got to work on this end of things. But she generally wanted a Scandi inspired vibe, which obviously a lot of people want, with naturally muted colors. But I suppose one thing that we kind of like pushed them on was the idea, sustainability wise, that, you know, if we're not doing it, like, our end user is the next generation in what we do. So if anybody's, you know, if the crown's on anybody's head to try and take that pressure, it's us to try and say to the clients, listen, you're literally creating environments for the next generation. So a big part of it as well was saying, well, you know, it has to feel like a hug. It has to be a Hygge, you know, inspired Montessori that is some version of a classroom of the future. I suppose from there, I mean, naturally enough, I suppose we landed on Riverside being the title. We ended up on a very biophilic focused element to it, which was the winding banks of the rivers and kind of playing by them as children, and the memories that brought up, and the feeling of the textures of the materials and the noises and the smells and the senses. I suppose from the very beginning of it, when you experience this Riverside building, it was honestly, inside it was a horrible place. It was operating as a nursery, and that's terrible to say, but, you know, even our client ourselves, Amy, you know, she said this is somewhere we inherited, and it's somewhere we have now have the opportunity to do something with. So it was the depths of COVID. We were having our socially distanced meetings. I was actually designing from France. I was there with my family, and Anna, my business partner, was holding the fort in London and having meetings. But the interior was just filled with walls and terrible carpet and a very, very claustrophobic environment. And for young children, especially, I suppose, well, for all of us, but for young children especially, you need room to grow and you need room to exist, and you need daylight to be a part of that as well. So a huge part of our design was taking those walls down, was letting daylight exists in that space and letting airflow happen again. A lot of I suppose healthcare facilities have this as well, and childcare facilities have it, where the idea of a cozy environment is sealed and shut, and it's perfect, but actually no fresh air is not a great thing in a childcare environment especially. So, you know, simple big decisions were made easy on that end of things. But then, by way of kind of the overall experience of entering into the place, you know, we created a willow fence at the front. We have a pebble from a riverbed is the handle of the gate as you enter through a cedar gateway. So from the very beginning, you're getting those textures, you know, just automatically they're there. And then, you know, as you move through into the reception area, we have a beautiful mobile that hangs and gets the wind through the door, and it moves and creates shapes of leaves as you move through it. And the reception has a tree in it. So, you know, you can't get more biophilic than that, right? But it has a tire swing hanging off it, or hanging just above it. So it's just kind of invoking those little moments that I suppose it's the classic thing, bringing the inside out and the inside in and whatever you want to say. But really for us in biophilia moment, you know, we wanted it to be an automatic feeling of the riverside moment versus, you know, fish or very, very obvious things. It was in the grander gestures. And then obviously that came through in bigger moments, like using recycled plastic bottle felt material, which created fish scales up a massive wall. The reflection of water was a big thing we played with, the use of mirrors in different spaces. Just kind of across the board, really, really focusing on the river and how it exists.
That's lovely. And I know you do a lot about biophilic design, and you're really passionate about it. And it really is really absolutely evident in that. And I think the kids really enjoy it. I mean, have you kind of had feedback from the kids and the staff as well? I mean, what's the feedback been?
Yeah, well, what was lovely in this space was that it was existing already. So there was families already going there, and there was children already going there. So they came back, and we were there the first day, and it was like, You know, I mean, it was changing rooms off the early 90s, right? It was that moment of like, is this really our space? What the hell's going on in here? Because it is so dramatically different. It definitely, when we're talking about kind of what would classrooms of the future look like, you know, there's a gross motor skills environment inside it, but it's kind of hidden and it's in its own place. And, you know, you can imagine being 4 years old, or as you say, you know, an adult being like, I just want to get in, I want to play, I want to climb up through that thing, I want to look out through the massive watery bubbles, and look down at my friends and interact. So yeah, the children have a fantastic time when they're, yeah. And then, you know, the adults obviously get stuck into.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a joy, isn't it? I think joy and awe and happiness. I mean, for me, biophilic design actually brings that in. It's that feeling that when we look at nature, when we look outside and we just go, oh my God, what a beautiful day. Or look at that tree and look at the bees that are buzzing around in that thing. It's those moments of fascination which stop us in our tracks and just fill our hearts and our, you know, with joy. That's just the word,
and,
isn't it?
You know? And I'm creating that those truly awesome moments, you know, like where and we like to play with scale a lot. So we like an adult to have just as much of that experience as a child. And, you know, imagine arriving into a three-story play structure that has giant river pebbles that you climb through at the bottom, you know. That sets you up for the day. You know, and as you say, that's what nature does. You know, when we go and we walk incredible forests or in huge mountain ranges, we stand and we stop in awe of that moment and we go, wow, okay, that's kind of reset my soul a little bit, and I can go on. And I suppose it cleanses your palate from the outside world too. You know, when children go into a learning environment, you like the idea that they're taking something else in. You know, it's different to their home environment, it's different to their environment with their relatives or their friend groups or whatever. So we like the idea of that. And I mean, we apply that same rule to, you know, restaurants, hotels, wherever it is, but obviously in classrooms, in a learning environment, it exists a bit differently.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And the kids will learn better, won't they, as well? But I do like that reset my soul. It's a brilliant thing. That's I'm gonna quote you on that a lot. So
go for it.
Asif, can I ask you, please, what were the standout things for this entry for you? I mean, you mentioned some at the beginning there, but what was...
Well, I don't know how to follow James's description, to be quite honest. It's quite comprehensive. I suppose one of the things I should mention is, effectively, we've all been... Well, people who are listening to this will be able to see the pictures. We've all been in those sorts of environments where a creche or where a nursery has been set up, and it has not been the primary use.
Yeah.
And it's been very much compromised. Now, what James has managed to do is, effectively, from that environment, with no outdoor space, by the way, is actually create something that is fantastic in terms of a child-centric view.
Mm.
And to do that with natural materials, I'd say it's probably the perfect anti-COVID sort of like project, because everything is eminently chewable, climbable, lickable. It is a project that is meant for kids of that age, and it works well. And from that, you know, you have the material choices in terms of, you know, so low toxicity, all the rest of it. But all of those breed out of all of those things. And to have that, you know, sort of like the reference of a natural environment makes it even more friendly. The rounded pebbles, no sharp surfaces. You know, you could really bounce up and down in this place and, you know, you really kick it around and it'll be fantastic. You know, I can see it lasting a long time. It is a good project for kids.
And fantastic. And you say, because it's going to last for ages, it's sustainable. it's really cool. I do want to talk about materials now, and it's a thing that keeps coming up. Actually, I give talks at different places, and we, you know, I kind of have a sort of practitioner thing on a first Friday of every month now. So, you know, different practitioners can just join, and we have a really informal lunchtime discussion, really, about things. And one of the things we are talking about a lot is our materials and finding something that's sustainable, that's biophilic. But, you know, but it's also beautiful, and that's going to, you know, so the colorways and all this kind of thing, which is why I was intrigued by both of your projects, because you're looking at things differently and how we can sort of push, like you're saying about the larch, Susie, as well, you know, how we can like look at materials in a different way and apply them. I mean, for you, I mean, each of you, I mean, what is it for about natural materials? I mean, obviously there's the biophilic design, and for me, biophilic design is using natural materials or things that reference nature. So even like you're saying, recycled plastic boxes and things. But maybe you could just talk a little bit about the sort of importance of materials. I mean, I don't know, Susie, could you maybe start a little bit?
So yeah, for the studio here, we wanted durability. That was, you know, it's a commercial space at the end of the day. I also didn't mention that part of this building is a garage as well. So we chose a flooring that is a natural stone that it's about 50 mil thick. We've got under floor heating, but it needed to be so durable that a car could drive on it, as well as it being beautiful and representative to a residential interior. So we have laid in a herringbone format these stone bricks, if you like. I felt so sorry for the tiler laying it, that these will be here for you know, yeah, 1,000 years, I think. You know, they're not going anywhere, but they solve so many different purposes. We have an inside outside space as well, so they flow from the inside to the outside. So that was one of the materials. The larch also, we wanted to preserve it on the outside with this Japanese burning method rather than treating it with chemical, and it has softened over the years so beautifully. But for me, the materials don't have to be tangible, and James touched on this beautifully. You know, the just using light is so important, and the way we've orientated this building to get the natural sunlight in to where the designers are working. Down here where I am in the meeting room, where we've got a screen, it's much darker, so we've orientated this towards the north. I think using that natural solar gain and solar loss is so important. You also mentioned ventilation and airflow, and the fact that although we've got many computers upstairs, it doesn't get overheated in the summer because we've got natural ventilation that comes through. We have the use of movement of water outside, so trying to use all of the natural elements in a way that will help the building and help the users. That so the natural sound of the water masks the noise from the neighbor and our noise from this commercial venture to them in a very relaxing, beautiful way, without, you know, them hearing what's going on. So for us in at the studio, we tried to use those elements in a clever way.
Yeah, I like the idea of using, and you know, actually intentionally using water to mask the sound. And also the clever use of, you know, using where the natural light comes in, and orientate the building that way.
I mean, I think good designers have been doing that for years, and it's just really being considered now as being part of the biophilic design movement as well. Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it my whole design life, but now it's just kind of got traction, hasn't it? Yeah. To use those methods.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sort of biophilic design is really kind of almost like a label that people can use to help them explain a principle, that we're going to do this because this helps you with this, that, and the other. You know, and I think it kind of collates all these different things. You know, and obviously, I mean, it must save energy costs as well. I mean, you must.
Well, at the end of the day, all of the sustainable elements that we've put in do save us money. Yeah. You know, we've got an air source heat pump. You know, we spend a bit on electricity, but nothing like it would be for oil or gas.
Yeah, exactly. That's a massive space you've got there as well. I mean, people who are looking on the video, you can see where you are at the moment. But then if you look at the images, oh my goodness, it's like, it's beautiful. I mean, it's lovely. You just want it's inviting. And like you said, that I didn't mention that at the beginning, but that outside in that you've done, and those, like you say, the tiling that goes in and out with those stones. I mean, they will last forever, and even if you wanted to take them up and repurpose them, you can. I mean, that's the lovely thing about stone things, isn't it? So for you, James, you touched on some of the things there, but materials, why are materials important to you, and using the sustainable ones and natural ones if you can?
Well, I think as I've pointed earlier about considered design choices from very, very early on is an important angle for us.
Yeah.
And that comes through in our process, as I said before about mentioning what we create, the brand book is essentially it's the design bible for the brands that we work with. So no matter how many sites they end up rolling out, we've given them the basis of what they should choose from. And that is as specific as saying certain flooring, certain materials, whether it comes to desks or walls or cupboards or whatever it is. And that, I suppose, is a twofold outcome on it. And, you know, when it's something like timber, an interesting point in Riverside is that, you know, the client decided to go with us when we said, listen, will we do, you know, plywood furniture? Will we create our own furniture range that really sets you apart? And brave clients are needed everywhere. I think we're all sitting here in a lovely biophilic bubble of environmentally friendly people. It's way, way easier to look at the catalog and go, those plastic tables are going to last. I know that because I've worked in the industry for the last 40 years and they're going to last. So it takes really, really brave clients to say, part of us redesigning our space is going to be R&D. We're going to take a little bit of a hit in this in the long run because this is better for all of us. Yeah. So there's kind of there's a two-pronged approach for us in that. So anywhere we can flex into pushing a client more where we believe that they're up for it, we do. And that, you know, that can be difficult. But if we're not designing properly for the kids of the future, then, you know, I suppose we should all just give up in what we're doing. When it comes to something like, you know, the flooring that we used in there is made from recycled flooring, you know, so it's not to say that whatever you're doing is always going to break or that it's going to be a difficult thing. It's saying that we have a lot of other materials we know will last. And even if you want to get rid of it, because as we all know, in commercial environments, things change, trends change, owners change. And sometimes they just want to change the thing. And if that thing is being part of a circular environment of recycling, then great. We know the guys that we can call in. We can rip up the floor again. It can get chopped up, made into new flooring, and we'll choose whatever after that. And I suppose there's just so many ways of doing it. And I suppose our job as designers is to guide clients through that process to say, listen, we've got the tools to try and help you there, and here are the suggested ways of getting there.
Yeah, it's this cooperation again, isn't it? It's back to that whole thing. It's education, it's getting them on board, it's talking to them right from day one, getting them excited about it and getting them to buy into it, really, isn't it?
And as Susie said from the off as well, listening to them, you know, really, especially what we do, you know, there will be operational things. Part of our process in the beginning, in a lot of environments, is talking to the staff in existing places as well. What works for you? What doesn't work for you? You know, like we'll do an anonymous Google questionnaire, and you know, some people will say the staff room has got no daylight. It's in the basement. You know, and then sometimes that's an operational loophole to go around because actually there's no other option. And we design, you know, we design in blue light, fake windows. We play tricks then. We work with mirrors, and we really try and create environments that people can feel good in, because, you know, we're not always blessed with all of the perfect scenarios. We've got to try and box smart, you know.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. No, especially when they're having a little bit of respite, they don't want to be stuck in a filing cabinet, do they, really? Which some of these places are. It's like, oh, well, you've got, so it's like, oh, also I find in some workplaces, do you go in and they're going, that's the well-being room, and you look at it and it's like, really? And it's usually got like the trays in there, the cardboard boxes, the spare stuff. And it's like, yeah, you're going to feel really chilled out there.
And I suppose that informs the environment as well for us, you know, like, say, children, noisy, naturally noisy environments, you know, so having a lot of sound absorbing materials that aren't just sound panels, you know, it's all woven into design. So then, as you say, staff retention is so important as well in businesses, you know, and caring for our nearest and dearest, whether it's the youngest or the oldest, you know, another area that we are very passionate about, but obviously don't design as much for it. You know, it's just care in general. Like, how does everyone exist in the care environment? And in a nursery early years environment, there's a lot more care than there is solely education. And I think that's as important for the staff as it is for the children.
Yeah, no, that's so true. It should be in our healthcare system, but that's a conversation for another day. another bee in my bonnet. Just before I sort of wrap up, I mean, I do want to ask if for you, I mean, obviously biophilic design, sustainability, I mean, what are your views on like how the two mold together, you know, the kind of natural light, the natural air, you know, do you see this as kind of being a way forward? You know, are there really any elements that you kind of like to see in more in buildings maybe, or?
I think Susie's touched upon this. It's timeless. Yeah. It is something that people have done for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I think what we've actually done, and it's partly to James's and your point, Vanessa, is effectively we've divorced ourselves from our environment to a large degree. Mm. We do not use light as in the same way that we used to. We do not use air in the same way that we used to. Any artificial source of that, the tricks that James was talking about, should be used as tricks. Mm. Only if it's not available. It makes no sense whatsoever to have an office building to have circadian lighting right up against a facade. Use the natural daylight.
Yeah.
It's there. Why do you need to play a trick on the body when, in matter of fact, it's already there? And I think that's quite a lot that's true with circadian, with circadian lighting and with biophilic processes. Is that we should make more use of the resources that we have and complement those, as opposed to saying that we got to trick ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. And I always think I've mentioned it a few times before on different podcasts and different things I've spoken on, but you know, we put plants, we go, oh, you can't put plants inside. You can't put plants. So they put all the plants by the window and they put all the staff by the wall. And it's like, no, you know, what's good for the plants should be good for the people. So like you're just saying, we should be looking at what's naturally there. Like Susie's done, it's like, well, where's the natural light coming in? And, you know, what can we do? So it's about being creative and clever and actually looking at the space and letting the space inform our design ideas, as well as the people and the use and all these things. And it's a lovely kind of family of ideas and inspiration, isn't it, really, for designers, for us all to get excited about. Before we wrap up and I ask the final question, I ask everybody on this, and I'm going to be really intrigued by each of you, and I'm not quite sure which order I'm going to do it in, so it's going to be a bit of a thing. I just want to remind people that if there are any interior designers listening to this podcast, which there are lots of, a few thousand, the Biophilic Design, the British Institute of Interior Design Awards deadline is on the 10th of April this year. And you'll be able to find the link that goes with the spiel with the podcast. And also, obviously, if you Google British Institute of Interior Design, you'll find it on their websites and look at the award page. Asif, I'm going to start with you, actually. So what if you could paint the world with a magic brush of biophilia, what would it look like?
It would be materials that we know where they come from and where they're going to. That legibility, I think, is something that we are sorely missing within the construction industry overall, is that we don't know where things come from. We consume them and we don't know where they're going to end up. So in terms of biophilic design, I think it's about using the natural materials, but knowing where they originated, what's their story and what happens to them after.
Lovely. Susie?
Of course, I'm going to echo that. And it's quite a question, actually, Vanessa. For me, it'd be about blurring the boundaries between the inside and the outside, and echoing also what you said, Vanessa, about using the spaces that you have available to the advantage of the inhabitants. Obviously using sustainable materials, designing to be energy efficient, and using the technology that we've got at our fingertips now in the most positive way to really embrace those technologies and not be scared by it. Just because you've got radiators existing doesn't mean to say you can't have a ground source and air source. Yes, it's an investment to begin with, but you know, I really advocate the use of it and how well they work, even in the cold UK. So
That's brilliant. That's good. And James, what would you do?
I love this question, by the way. I think it's always like kind of the end bit you really want to wait for, right? My answer might not be as crazy, wacky, creative as our work might portray continually, but I think it's a bigger one overall. And I discussed it with Anna, my co-founder, recently. And it's the idea that if there was a chance of like a Disney magic spell that we could just put on everyone, absolutely every single person, to design and create a world that is nature first. Because it's the bigger gestures that are needed. And we're all great in our, you know, in the work that we all do. But if everybody was entirely thinking on that level first, imagine developers, imagine landowners, imagine landlords, imagine designers, imagine everybody in their day to day, how we would all think entirely differently as a process. So yeah, I mean, it's a bit of magic, but you know, you've given me a magic brush, so let's use it.
Thank you for listening to the Journal of Biophilic Design podcast.